It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When it comes to politics, the United States is a deeply divided nation, and many of us have family members who are on different sides of the political gulf. Following this divisive election, people everywhere are now preparing to get together for some intensive quality time with family for the holidays, and there may be some awkward or heated moments. This hour, we'll explore the nature of political division with psychologist and sociologist Rob Willer of Stanford University, and family therapist Volker Thomas will also be here to share some practical advice for coping and communicating during the holiday season. But first, we sent our Iowa Public Radio production assistant, Gray Lanta, out to downtown Iowa City to ask people if this election has made it difficult for them to talk to members of their families.
I don't know. I guess this is the first election that I've been more judgmental towards people, and it's harder for me to definitely, like, talk to someone and knowing how they've sided, I guess. I feel like that's maybe clouded my judgment.
I mean, I have to be honest. I had two friends on Facebook that I deleted after, you know, some political rants that, you know, I felt were pretty, pretty inappropriate. But, yeah.
I don't. My family is all Republican. And my mom told me I was the oldest of four girls. And one night, shortly before she died, she said, "Jenny, I have something to tell you." I said, "What?" She said, "If you ever decide to run for any political office as a Democrat, I will not vote for you." And I said, "Mom, I'm your favorite daughter." She said, "I know."
It's really funny. We have a divided house, so I voted differently than my husband. I voted for Clinton. He voted for Trump. But I don't think it's something that's worth really fighting over. You know, people have their reasons.
Well, yeah, so I come from a Republican family, and I've embraced the Republican Party since I was a child, and most of my friends are Democrats. So it was tough this election season. We had a lot of arguments, but I had to stick to my own party and voted for Trump. We just decided not to talk about it anymore, but we might end up talking about it tomorrow at like 5 p.m., just meeting up and talking about it.
Some voices from downtown Iowa City talking about difficulties, talking about politics with friends and family. We're all just about to get together with our families. And Rob Willard is here with me now. He's a professor of sociology and psychology at Stanford University. He studies the political divide. Rob, thank you so much for being here.
Sure. It's a pleasure.
So we all have this sense that we are more divided than ever before. Does your research bear that out? Are we right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's exactly right. People's impressions that America is more divided are generally true. Probably the biggest measure of political polarization that's at record levels these days is inter-party animosity. So liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, however you want to measure it, show more, you know, dislike for one another than they did a generation ago.
You recently gave a TED Talk, and in the TED Talk, you made an analogy talking about imagining what kind of movie we are in at this moment. Tell us about some of your thoughts on that front.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sort of a movie buff, and I am always kind of thinking, when I think about some sort of social pattern as a social psychologist, I'm thinking, what kind of movie should we think of ourselves as being in with this pattern that we're in? And I was sort of playing around with different ways to think about this. And, you know, the one that we're all tempted to think we're in is some sort of zombie apocalypse movie, right? Where, you know, the zombies are arrayed against us, you know, they don't think for themselves. There's this mindless mass, and they're going to ruin the country. And, you know, you always think that you are the good guy in the zombie apocalypse movie, you and people that think like you. But what we have to remember is that people that support the other party, the other end of the ideological spectrum, they think they're the good guys.
And you're the zombie.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, in the end, I kind of would like to believe that maybe instead we're in a buddy cop movie. One of those movies where, you know, there's a good cop and a bad cop, or, you know, like a messy cop, and an organized cop, whatever it is, black cop and a white cop. you know, they get along in the end despite these differences that once divided them. And then when they do, you know, this feeling of solidarity that they can achieve is greater because they had to clear this divide. And I'd like that to be the future that we work towards.
All right. Well, we will watch that in the long term and see if that bears out. Certainly things are looking bad right now for the end of that film. But that's what always happens in a movie, right?
They do, yeah. But I think, this is really my main thought. A lot of people have asked me since I studied political persuasion, you know, what should we do around Thanksgiving? My main thought is run toward the fire, which feels wrong. It feels like the opposite of your instincts to engage, you know, to not avoid politically, you know, differently minded family members, to avoid political subjects entirely. It may seem like that's the right thing to do, but I actually think that this could be the beginning of bringing the country back together.
Well, let's
use family to get there.
All right. Let's talk about some of the things that you have learned about how people can have these conversations and even persuade one another. And I guess, you know, right now there's been a lot of conversation about empathy, trying to understand someone who voted for a candidate that you really find or found morally reprehensible in many ways. And again, I'm talking on both sides of this campaign. You were just, it sounds like you were talking about persuasion. I mean, don't we have to start with that understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think to be effective in persuading somebody else in your life, including a family member, it's going to start with understanding their perspective. And, you know, given how horribly divisive these times are, you could maybe just set a moderate goal for Thanksgiving of just achieving some sort of mutual understanding, maybe not convincing your Trumper or Clinton-supporting uncle, you know, to flip sides over the dinner table. Maybe that's a little too ambitious this year. Maybe you work on that over a 2 or 3 year period. So if we wanted to turn the heat down on this conflict, I think it really does start with some sort of empathy. And it doesn't even have to be the kind of empathy where you say, like, oh, you know, I support Donald Trump too. You know, my uncle's right. It just has to be understanding their perspective. And as we try to understand one another's perspective in this divided country, I think one of the most useful things is to realize that the political divide in our country is undergirded by a deeper moral divide. So robust, you know, consistent, reliable research shows that liberals and conservatives in America, on average, tend to endorse different moral values to different degrees. So liberals tend to be more concerned with values like protection from harm, care, equality, fairness, these sorts of protecting vulnerable groups and so on. And then conservatives, more than liberals, tend to be concerned with values like loyalty, patriotism, respect for authority, moral purity, religious sanctity. And once we realize that liberals and conservatives are coming from these different places morally, that can be very helpful in understanding where their politics come from and also figuring out how to communicate your politics in a persuasive way to them.
And you suggest trying to find some sort of commonality. So how would you go about doing that?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do that. I mean, you know, at a simple level, you can just try to find some place where you actually do agree, you know. I mean, a lot of liberals and conservatives this year could find agreement on some sort of anti-establishment position. Like, you know, isn't the system kind of broken and not doing what it should, you know, not looking out for everyday people like us or something like that, you know. So there's some room for those kind of modest agreements. But if you want to find a common ground that can be persuasive and help you communicate the virtues of your political positions, we recommend a technique that we call moral reframing. And moral reframing involves couching your political position in terms of the values of the person you're talking with. Because what it turns out we tend to do is when we go to persuade somebody that our political position makes sense, we tend to make arguments in terms of our own moral values. But when you're crossing the ideological divide, that means you're trying to turn somebody, you're trying to flip somebody on not just, you know, their national health insurance, which, as we know, challenging enough, but you're also trying to get them to embrace values that are not the primary values for them. So
you almost have no chance.
Yeah. you know, people really care deeply about their moral values. I mean, and these are, by definition, people's most deeply held beliefs. And so if you're trying to move somebody on something and they have to give up those beliefs that they hold most dear to agree with you, I mean, that's just not going to work. So instead, if you're, you know, if you say you're trying to convince your Republican uncle that same-sex marriage is a just policy, you might focus less on equality and fairness, even if that's your reason for supporting this position, and maybe focus more on group loyalty and patriotism. Talk about how gay Americans are loyal, hardworking, patriotic Americans that serve in the military and want the same things that other Americans do, including the right to marry the people they love. And we've tested that message and found that that's significantly more persuasive than a more conventional message for same-sex marriage to a conservative.
And I know that you did very specific research about this. Did you find that with this moral reframing, because I know you looked at it from a conservative angle and a liberal angle, did you find that a group of a particular ideology was easier to persuade or more resistant to persuasion?
Oh, that's an excellent question. We didn't really. I mean, I think in general we would say that it's not easy to move anybody in this country. You know, like, you need a good argument. You know, you can't just say, you know, I'm trying to advocate for national health insurance. I'm gonna connect that to respect for authority and then just try to make it work. Well, there's not necessarily an obvious argument to make there. You know, instead, you really got to find a good fit. So if you're trying to convince a liberal to agree with the conservative position that we should have high levels of military spending, you know, you really kind of got to think, like, well, what would be that persuasive argument if you're going to move somebody on this issue? And, you know, we found in that case that if you wanted to move liberals to support high levels of military spending, if you made an argument in terms of how the military offers minorities and the poor an opportunity to achieve on a level playing field and get access to college and, you know, advancement in society, you know, we found that kind of argument persuasive. So I guess what I would say is that our takeaway is liberals and conservatives equally difficult to persuade, but it's possible. It is possible.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about political divisions and political divisions at the Thanksgiving table this hour. With me right now, Rob Willer. He is a sociologist and psychologist at Stanford University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are living in a politically divided country. Many of us have politically divided families, and that is causing a lot of anxiety as we head into this holiday season, getting together for some intensive quality time with family. Maybe difficult this year as you try to come together after one of the most divisive elections in U.S. history. This hour, I'm talking with Rob Willer. He is a sociologist and psychologist at Stanford University. He has studied this political divide and also ways that people can come together, empathize, and persuade each other even. We'll talk more about that. And we're also going to bring a family therapist into the conversation in just a moment. But also remember that if you're facing this kind of anxiety, you're not alone. There was a piece that aired on StoryCorps on Morning Edition on November 4th that features Jen Stanley. She's a 29-year-old liberal writer. Her father, Peter, is a conservative construction worker. They could not be farther apart on the political spectrum, but they sat down together to talk to each other with StoryCorps. Let's listen.
I try to not bring up politics, but you always watch 5 o'clock news, and the minute any politician steps on, it doesn't matter who it is, I just cringe. And,
me too.
Yeah, but you have to say something, whereas I would like to just pretend it's not happening.
Or maybe the answer is we don't watch the news when you're there.
Maybe. But now I feel like we've gotten to this point where we're together and we're fighting about politics.
And those would be the times when I hear you say, I can't even talk to you, Dad. And if you're going to flip out about it, then you know what? I'd rather you didn't talk to me.
But see, this is what drives me crazy. You start these conversations.
Well, I ask questions. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? It's me trying to glean information from somebody who is significantly more educated than I am and whose opinions I trust.
I'm really surprised to hear you say that. I had no idea that you were genuinely interested in what I had to say. I thought that you wanted to tell me how I was wrong and also make a joke about how I was silly.
Well, I would never feel that way about you. I have nothing but respect for you. I don't agree with you all the time. I don't agree with you most of the time, but that's okay. We have a lot of things in common, and I do know that everything you did when you were a little kid was because you wanted to be like me. You even played softball, which you hated because I love baseball.
I did really hate it. I mean, I just really worshipped you, Dad. I just thought that, like, everything that you thought and said was right. Mm-hmm. And you were just my best friend. But I think as I got older, I realized that you were really wrong about a lot of things.
Well, you're probably right, Jen. I never professed to be right about everything. The important thing in our relationship is that I respect you for your beliefs. You were raised to be a sensitive, caring person, and that's exactly who you are.
You say that, mm-hmm. and I feel loved, but I think you used to like me, and I don't necessarily know that you like me anymore.
Oh, yeah, I like you a lot. It doesn't make me feel good that you say that. I don't agree with everything you say and do, but do I like you? Yeah, you bet I do. And I'm extremely proud of you. You know, when my time comes to say, yeah, my father was a good man, we didn't agree politically, but he was a good man. And if you can say that, then I'll be happy.
I don't think that you're right all the time, but I think you're the best man.
Well, thanks.
And you're the best dad.
That's Jen Stanley and her father, Peter Stanley. Again, they are very, very far apart on the political spectrum. They came together to talk during StoryCorps, and that conversation aired on Morning Edition on November 4th before the election. And I think it gives us an opportunity to really explore some of the things that make political divisions so difficult for family members. With me, Rob Willer. He's a professor of sociology and psychology at Stanford University. Also joining us now is Folker Thomas, who is a retired professor and a couple and family therapist at the Counseling Center in Iowa City. Hello, Folker.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And, you know, earlier we were talking about the very strongly held morals of people on opposite sides of the political divide. And when we listen to a father and a daughter talking to each other, Folker, I think it really brings up the fact that when in a family there are people with very different political views, it can feel like a rejection of the values that maybe somebody was raised with or the values that a parent or a child holds so dear. Is that part of what makes this so difficult for families?
Well, what makes it more complicated is that then these adult daughter and father are political adversaries, but they're still in different family roles. You know, children grow up in being exposed and raised with the morals of their parents. And at some point, they become independent and form their own. Quite often, they're the same as their parents. Quite often, they're very different. So if they're very polarized times politically, it, of course, trickles down or is reflected in family relationships as well. And when the relationship of a daughter or father, like in this case, then overlaps with the political adversary part, then it becomes complicated and then becomes a matter of, do you like me as the daughter? You know, thought, do you love me just because I think differently than you do? And but what makes it even more complicated is that the emotions that are associated with that can run so high, I think Rob called it hot, that then it becomes really a matter of, oh, this is not about political differences anymore. This is whether you accept me as your daughter, whether you accept me as your father. I think the example of this father-daughter pair showed on how it can be done. Unfortunately, at least the families I see, they can't do that. The father can't say, I respect you despite of your political convictions. And the daughter can say, you know, I really, you know, you're my hero, although I disagree with you. And that makes it so complicated.
Yeah, this is certainly a very, an extraordinary conversation.
Yes.
Not the kind of thing that is happening in households all over America
right now, probably. That's right.
With the beginning of that conversation, she was talking about how she wants to avoid all of these political topics with her father. And I think a lot of us have that idea in our minds. Like, well, we can have a good Thanksgiving if we just don't talk politics at all. So what do you think about avoidance? Is that a good technique?
For some families, it is. You know, for some families, it's not. what I tell families when they choose this avoidance strategy is think carefully about what you miss when you avoid. If you miss really blow-ups, and you've had blow-ups over the holidays, which is not that uncommon, I think then the strategy of avoidance is probably a good strategy. Yeah, if it's just a matter of that you feel so uncomfortable, that you're just afraid of not being accepted by whoever the other family members are, well, maybe then I would encourage you to have the courage and talk on that level, not just on the political level, but on the level of relationship with the person you are disagreeing with, so that it not becomes then a matter of trying to convince the other family member that you are right and the other family is wrong, but that it is a matter of, which is kind of in a way what happens in families so often, that it becomes a matter of either or, of right and wrong. Everything gets dichotomized. And unfortunately, right now, there are many role models in public life who right. practice that. So that, but that it can become a matter of both and, which sometimes can end up in agreeing to disagree and to let it sit there for the time being without a blow up, because family relationships are more important than the adversarial convincing of the other person that you're right and the other person is wrong.
Well, and Rob, I think that returns to what you were saying earlier about finding common ground, common moral ground, which in the case of a family seems like it should be easier to do than with someone else in your life.
Yeah, you would think so. it's of course still very challenging, but you know those bonds of family are so great that I think, you know, if you can find that common ground and even just have a civil conversation that where you express respect and understanding of the other person's perspective, which we should, you know, we should all be able to achieve that for beloved family members, or at least understand them by hearing their words. You may find that though you haven't made progress on persuading them that your positions are better ones than they thought they were, though I think you can actually achieve that. You may find actually that they walk into the next room they're in and they're a little more open-minded towards the, you know, the differently minded person they talk to next, or, you know, that they're maybe even advocating for some of your positions being more reasonable. Because what we have right now is so much, you know, so much caricaturing of the other side that even just fleshing out what, you know, what it is to have liberal or conservative positions and putting that to a real person that somebody cares about can be a form of progress.
Volker?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, there is a characterization and caricature within families as well. You know, that a daughter, for instance, can only see her father as somebody who doesn't let her be who she wants to be. And a father only sees his daughter as somebody who wants to be different and that he failed as a father, which, by the way, was not the case in our example. But I've seen that many times. And so then people put each other into a position, into a family position that is consistent then with the political opinion that is different from mine, that runs emotions so high and there's so much defensiveness that they really can't, you know, get away from this. If you're right, I'm wrong, and I'm wrong, I'm right, so you are wrong. So it makes it very difficult. And then to, in a way, help them, and that's what we do actually then in family therapy sessions, to regulate their emotions, their affect down, so that they can open their mind. Because people who are afraid, people who are angry, don't have an open mind. It's closed. And they just, all they do is defend on what they think and what they are convinced of.
This hour, we're talking about political divisions and why they are so difficult to navigate when it comes to political divisions within a family. And, of course, we are, many of us, getting together with family coming up in the next week or so. I know some people who have decided not to go home for Thanksgiving mm-hmm. because of the political divisions. I also have heard stories of parents and children who are no longer speaking to each other. So, I mean, these divides are heated and and difficult right now. If you'd like to join our conversation and share your experiences, your concerns, maybe your solutions, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I got an email this morning from Mike Draper of Raygun, the T-shirt company, and he said that that was the number one thing that they heard in the store right after the election was people coming in say, well, Thanksgiving's going to be weird. So a lot of people, they also made some very funny coasters and dish towels in response to that. But a lot of people are bringing a lot of anxiety to this. And Folker, you and I have talked before about holidays. I mean, this season is kind of loaded for families because we have incredibly high expectations. So what are some of the what's some of the baggage that we're bringing into the holiday season that, that may make this even worse?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is what is needed is courage. Courage to allow yourself to be who you are and to respect the other family members. We can't go in to Thanksgiving and expect that our family does the job that the politicians have not been doing. That's not going to work. But to have some respect and to look at actually, you know, when I'm originally from Germany, so in Hawaii, this whole campaigning for me is still something that is fairly foreign, although I'm a U.S. citizen, I've been voting. But one thing that to me is so amazing on how everything gets reduced to either or, to good or bad, to truth and lie. So things that are fairly, could be fairly easy to handle become a matter of morality. And if that runs cross in families, then they come in with the expectation that it's going to be just like a debate that we've seen on TV in this family. And I'm afraid of that. If they can look more carefully that they actually have still quite a bit they agree upon, you know, which just seems to be right now amazing even thought, oh, there could be some overlap. So it's not at the polar ends of what Republicans want and what Democrats want, but there's a lot of in between. Of course, nobody talks about that. And if family members can that explore, maybe they can hear each other a little better.
Does the idea that holidays need to be fun family time, does the idea that, you know, this holiday is something we've done, you know, every year, our whole lives, we need to have that same kind of sense of togetherness and love and understanding, do our expectations set us up for failure here?
Of course. Unfortunately, there are sometimes expectations, actually they're fairly common, is that this Thanksgiving we're going to make up for all the grievances that we have accumulated over all of our lives. Right?
Okay.
Personal grievances, political grievances, and finally this year it's going to work. And of course, that's an expectation that's unrealistic. It's not going to work.
You know, Rob, listening to what you were talking about earlier, I was struck by the research that you've done about persuasion and about how to help people understand your viewpoint and how little of that is employed in political campaigning. So, in a way, everything that we've seen through the whole campaign went counter to all of the research you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the sad things about our two-party system is that the incentives are laid out for you to consolidate your base, get the people that already agree with you fired up to definitely turn out to vote and to convince other people to turn out to vote, and then make some sort of efforts towards the middle. And but, you know, even this year, where there was so much anti-establishment, you know, fury on each side, there was, you know, there wasn't even that much incentive to go to the middle, you know, and so you didn't even see a ton of that. Certainly Donald Trump didn't do much of that. And so, you know, it's very difficult because people are hearing, as you said, all day, every day from, you know, partisan media and the politicians that they look to see how should I think about politics? How should I talk about it? They're seeing people preaching to the choir. They're seeing people that are themselves locked in partisan echo chambers. And that's your role model. You know, that's a very difficult situation.
Well, and we've also talked about on this program yesterday, actually, and in many other places, how people have curated their online lives to do away with any kind of opposition or the voices of people who think differently. So is that adding to the problem?
It absolutely adds to the problem. And I think that, you know, one of the difficulties is when, you know, when you're so convinced that the other side is wrong, and that's really an issue of values and morality, and you believe your values, your politics are the right ones, you're so ready to consume potentially not factual information that, you know, feeds your side and demonizes the other side. You know, there's these stories, there's stories about, you know, memes that went viral and, you know, honestly, especially on the Republican side in the last election cycle, were just things that are just blatantly untrue.
Right.
But, you know, people want to believe them. Not that this is confined to the right. It isn't.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, sociologist and psychologist Rob Willer of Stanford University and family therapist Folker Thomas of Iowa City. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Thanksgiving is coming, and of course, other holidays follow that one quite quickly. This is the season where we spend a lot of time with family members, and people are feeling some anxiety this year if they come from a politically divided family. Those Thanksgiving conversations can be difficult. We are exploring political divisions this hour and what we understand about them, what we know about how to navigate them, and why they are so tricky when it comes to family relationships. With me, Rob Willer. He is a sociologist and psychologist at Stanford University. He studies the political divide. Also with me, family therapist Folker Thomas, who is a counselor at the Counseling Center of Iowa City and a retired professor of couple and family therapy at the University of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation. What's on your mind as you're thinking about getting together with family this holiday season? 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. What are you nervous about? What have you been able to do in the past to diffuse these conversations and maybe make it a positive situation? We want to hear your stories. And, Rob, just before the break, we were talking about how, in some ways, our online presence, the time we spend in social media, has allowed us to build these bubbles, where these echo chambers, where we just have our ideas reinforced, we talk to like-minded people, we interact with like-minded people, and we can just hide the rest. And the social networks are built to enhance that. But also something that I see a lot online, Rob, is that the way people interact with each other is so much less civil than if they were face-to-face. And sometimes the people you're interacting with that in that uncivil way on your Facebook page, that may also be your cousin or your uncle or somebody that you might be seeing over the holidays. I mean, does that kind of uncivil discourse online also make face-to-face conversation more difficult?
I think so. Yeah, you're I think, spot on about how in online communication, our sense of the other person is really flattened. We don't regard how our words and the things we're saying might impact them. We feel kind of somewhat anonymous. And of course, we have this impoverished ability to communicate affect and emotion in our communication. Things that we write that we think sound neutral, in fact, sound hostile. And things that we write that are hostile come off as very hostile. So, you know, it's very hard to have these kinds of low trust, cross tribe, if you will, interactions in that online environment. But this is exactly why Thanksgiving is a great opportunity, you know, because, you know, even if you haven't had a conversation online, you know, with your, you know, Democrat, your crazy Democrat niece, you know, who's off at college and has all these new ideas, like, you know, you maybe both have this sense that you have this divide that's pushing you apart just for lack of even talking about it. And this is the opportunity. This is the opportunity to gain mutual understanding, to communicate respect and love for a family member that has different beliefs than you, but who you nonetheless can learn from, at least learn how it is that somebody in their right mind could have these different political views and vote for the opposite candidate. And that mutual understanding is the beginning of sewing our country back together.
As somebody who studies persuasion, does anyone ever convince anyone in online conversations to think of it in a different way, ever?
Yeah, I mean, that's Yeah, that's an outstanding question. You know, it's funny. We actually, in our research, we tested persuasive messages in online environments. Now, granted, these came from kind of authority source. You know, these were like mocked up op-eds, and so they seemed like something maybe an expert would write. But, you know, we found that the moral reframing technique, because it validates the fundamental beliefs and humanity of the person that, you know, that you're targeting for persuasion, tended to actually be effective. I think when somebody reads that message, they think, oh, wait a minute, I'm reading something about immigration that I don't agree with, but all of the language of this persuasive message is my moral vocabulary, so I feel like somebody's actually flattering my values right now. And you kind of catch them off guard, and they can be more open to being persuaded.
Interesting. Well, and I think about how so many people, because they have access to these social networks, they kind of pour all of their political resources into making their Facebook post or their tweet. And, I mean, in many ways, that may be the least useful place to put that energy.
Yeah. In sociology, we call this slacktivism. Being activist online in an environment where it maybe doesn't make a very big difference. And you see on both the, on both the left and the right right now, you know, people really pouring themselves into getting each other worked up. And, you know, there's a value to that. It's not completely purposeless to get each other worked up, you know, to work towards a cause. But you have to remember in most online environments that other people are watching that don't agree with you. And you need to also be persuasive to them. I think in our research, one of the biggest dualities that we keep hitting upon is this tension between what is useful discourse amongst like-minded political actors and what is useful discourse across political groups. And so, you know, that same rabble-rousing thing that can maybe get a group of people worked up enough to be activists or to push for some sort of legislation or turn out to vote, that language is completely different than the kind of language, the kind of discourse you want to have if you're reaching out to somebody of a different political stripe from your own. That conversation is totally different. And people aren't very good at switching like that because it's, you know, it's inherently difficult.
Right. And well, and then the instant gratification that you get from people agreeing with you and reinforcing your idea and posting things in agreement, that just feeds on itself, right?
Yeah, it really does. And it is a sad thing that we don't get as excited about diffusing tensions between groups as we do about, you know, finding that confirmation and verification within our group. But I think, you know, again, returning to this buddy cop movie analogy, you know, we should remember that while rare, that feeling of coming together with someone when you started far apart, I mean, it is actually quite exhilarating. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a really good feeling. And we don't have it very much, so we forget, you know, how good it is. But especially within a family or a friendship network, somebody you went to school with, somebody you grew up with, coming together despite difference, it's a good thing. It really feels good. And this, you know, again, Thanksgiving is an opportunity to do exactly that.
Well, and Sarah Sweet C on Twitter wants to disagree with something I said earlier. She says, in answer to the question, has anybody ever been convinced online? Absolutely. I've learned more online than in any other venue. So a differing opinion, although I think specifically I was talking about those impassioned pleas on social media or insults on social media that also, you know, get passed around. Let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Evan's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Evan.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have some? Yeah. Did you have some anxiety going into Thanksgiving, or just some good ideas?
I think it's good ideas. Most of the people around the table are going to be agreeing. But my experience with difficult meals is with a mother-in-law, and first of all, I think the food is always a safe subject, and you can talk about all about how it was made and the recipes and everything. And then going back into the past, things the family might have done in the past that they all enjoyed. And then I would say, finally, whatever the provocation, do not throw the first stone. You know, just sit there and grit your teeth if you have to.
Evan, sounds like you've been there and successfully done that.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. And, Folker, I mean, what's your response to that advice?
Well, that's avoidance strategy. Mm-hmm. And for many families, that probably is the safest way to go. Let me suggest a little different, a newer strategy. And that is going back to social media. Mm-hmm. Especially younger people are socialized in social media, which means that they don't get direct feedback of what they say. There's a lag in there. And so what I've done, and that could be done very easily over Thanksgiving, instead of not going into social media over Thanksgiving, to have 2 hours, maybe instead of watching football, for everybody who is on Twitter, to tweet each other, and then see what changes after that. I did that actually a couple of months ago with the family, and they came back and said, "Wow, I never knew on how different a conversation on Twitter is from a conversation face to face."
Interesting. So, what do you think they took away from that?
Well,
I mean that it's different.
To acknowledge that there is direct feedback. Mm. So in a way, you don't have time after a tweet when you get a tweet back to think about it and to feel about it. You have to do it right in real time. And so at least for them, some of the family members, that made them more cautious and more reflective and thinking about what they were going to say before they said it. When they're on Twitter, they just would tweet it and see what happens after that.
Interesting. We're going to go back to the phones now. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Rita is on the line in Garber. Hi, Rita.
Hi. See, I'm in an area where we saw a lot of Trump signs in the last few weeks. But I have a daughter who works in Des Moines and works with Hispanic people. And she said those people are scared to death of what the future might bring for them, and that makes her afraid as well, and it threatens her business. And I just wonder about how to deal with the fear factor in wondering what's going to happen in the future, especially, you know, for people who have friends and relatives who are dealing with that kind of fear.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question, Rita. Folker, what's your thought on that?
You know, in a way, we've talked more kind of implicitly about fear and anger. You know, there are families in which everybody is afraid. And there it becomes a matter of parents validating the fear that children have in the face of their own fears so that they actually can come together and overcome the fear and deal with the fear rather than, and I've seen that many times, that parents can't tolerate their children's fears because of their own. And that opens up then space to communicate with others who have similar fears in other families or in businesses. I think it really is a matter of being able to validate fear, as it is important to validate people who have different opinions. It's so important to validate, especially in these families who are afraid, and there are many of them right now, you know, to be able to do that. And there is where the parents have a responsibility towards their kids.
Now, in a lot of families right now, you know, there are many, many different groups of people that, as a candidate, Donald Trump called out and talked about, mm-hmm. you know, different things about these groups. And, of course, it includes racial minorities, ethnic, different ethnic backgrounds, people from different countries, but also people with different sexual orientations. And so there, of course, are many families that are racially mixed, ethnically mixed, but there are probably even more families where sexual orientation is an issue. And so a member of a family may be very frightened, feel like a very vulnerable person in this environment, and be going home to have Thanksgiving dinner with people that they feel, you know, voted for someone that wants to oppress them. I mean, mm-hmm. that creates a really hot situation right now.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that really is a matter of the people, the family members who have more power than others, generationally, parents and children. You know, that the ones who have more power acknowledge that it is okay to have these fears because that calms it down. And then to have conversations with other families who are in very similar situations so that they're not isolated and feel like it's only happening to me. It's happening all over the place, and then they can activate.
As I mentioned earlier, there are parents and children not speaking to each other. Mm-hmm. There are also a lot of people who think, you know what, I can't go home. Mm-hmm. I just can't go home. And is that okay? You know, if you're feeling scared, if you're feeling personally rejected because of the way your family voted, to isolate yourself, I mean, that seems really sad. But if you're feeling afraid, as a therapist, what would you recommend to somebody?
Well, for the time being, I would accept it. Because if I then said, no, you have to overcome your fear and face your family members, you know, then I would do to that person in a way what has been done to them and what has generated that fear. And there are people whose anxiety is so high that at the time they cannot be with family members because it's not safe. And safety is what is the most important thing for them at that time. So, you know, I would very carefully explore with them how safe or unsafe they feel if they went home. And if they feel so unsafe, you know, that they are afraid that something is happening to them, abusive, even in their family, then I support them in not going. And that doesn't mean for the rest of their lives. That means for this year. What happens next year that can be explored next year?
We have a comment from Cindy near Ames. Based on everything else I know about my sister's extended family, including their church affiliation, I'm pretty sure they vote differently than I do, but we all get along very well and haven't talked about politics for 35 years. So is there any good reason to change that now? All I can think of are reasons not to. What do you think, Rob? You said run toward the fire earlier. They've been avoiding the subject for 35 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that's what works for you, you know, fair enough. If that's necessary to maintain a good family relationship, then, you know, who would I be to advise a different strategy? But of course, as a sociologist, I'm always sort of thinking about what's best for the larger society. And I do think that, you know, we have this trouble of seeing common humanity across party lines in America, and families are a really likely place to start fixing that problem. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and I wouldn't say sacrifice your family to save American politics. It's a ridiculous idea. I think we can have it both. I think we can have both those things. I think we can have respect for family members and also, you know, start to see that humanity across party lines and maybe even build some political coalitions.
All right. And maybe watch a buddy cop movie over the holidays?
Yeah, it works in my family. We pretty much just run the one after another.
All right. And it's good to remember that everybody thinks they're the good guy in this situation. I think that does help create empathy, Rob.
Absolutely. And maybe, you know, give them a little credit and acknowledge that within the information, you know, space that they're in and in their moral worldview, they probably are the good guys, you know. And so, you know, really, you know, having a deep conversation where you come to understand, you know, why did your cousin vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? You know, this seemingly impossible decision for someone who you know to be generally a good person.
Might be good to listen. Rob Willer, thank you so much. Sociologist and psychologist at Stanford University and family therapist Volker Thomas, thank you.